You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the items on my bucket list is to be fluent in a couple of languages other than English. I'm not too far on that yet. I have a few phrases and a few words, but fluent, no. And I'm envious of those who have mastered two or three languages. But what about people who are fluent in five, six, or even eight or nine languages or more? Well, that's the subject of my guest book today, Babel No More. And the Babel refers to the biblical Tower of Babel, highlights these polyglots who have functional fluency in 10, 20, or even 30 languages. In a day with increasingly no borders between peoples, knowing languages is a competitive edge in business, a safety issue in industries such as aviation, and a national security necessity in defense, intelligence, and diplomatic circles. My guest today is linguist Michael Erard. He has written about language for Science, Slate, Wired magazines, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. His new book is titled Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. It's published by the Free Press. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Michael Erard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Rich. Thanks for having me.
What started you on this quest to learn more about polyglots, the ability to speak multiple languages? And I guess a polyglot is defined by what, six languages?
Yeah, I mean, polyglot, technically, you're just going to be more than one.
Right.
I think that, you know, in usage, you start saying polyglot when quadrilingual sounds just too confusing or awkward. But it's really the question of when does multiple language learning get and, you know, become something that looks extraordinary. And so an early definition of a hyperpolyglot was someone who spoke six or more, because there's the notion that there are communities where very ordinary people and where all of the people speak five languages. So if you have six or more, you're doing something that's kind of humanly extraordinary.
So what started you on this quest to learn about these hyperpolyglots or polyglots?
Yeah, you know, it really started in my own adolescence, I think, when I said, my mother every summer used to say, what are you going to do this summer? And write out a list, and I would always kind of put out on the list, learn French, because the family is ethnically French. But, you know, because I had this idea that, like, speaking lots of languages was what you did to be cosmopolitan, and the reading that I did was about, you know, it was a lot of Hemingway, and there's all this Spanish and French, and he seemed to have no problem moving. So it seemed that seemed like a reasonable thing to aspire to do, but it became really frustrating. I did eventually study Spanish and lived in Colombia in Latin America for my junior year of college, and then after college I lived in Taiwan teaching English, and I picked up some Mandarin. And I also at that, you know, sort of envisioned this future, spending the next decade traveling around Asia, collecting languages and things like that. And it was much harder doing that than I thought. So that's where I got, I think, an appreciation for, like, what it really meant to be able to speak a lot of languages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was working as a journalist in 2003, 2004, writing stories about linguists and linguistics. And there was an interesting discussion on a linguistics listserv. Someone asked, who is the world's most lingual person? So who is the person who has spoken the most languages in the world? And there were a lot of names that were bandied about, but quite a lot of discussion about what that would even mean, and could such a person even exist? And so I wrote a magazine article about it, kind of on the science of massive multilingualism like this. But it was clear that there was so much more to the story, because the characters are so interesting, and you need to delve into them, and you need to delve into their times, and you also need to spend a lot of time talking about what does it mean to speak a language, and what does it mean to know a language, and whose standards are the right ones to apply to that question of who is the world's most lingual person.
Now, the way you start the story is through this, 19th century Italian cardinal named Joseph Mezzofanti, who apparently knew, 70 languages, maybe?
Well, yeah, I mean, the numbers that are attributed to him really vary. By the end of his life, he never gave a list of everything that he could do. Earlier in his life, he was telling people, that he could speak 45 languages and his mother tongue, which is Bolognese. And so some people say 36 languages, some people say 72. Now, the 72 number is religiously significant because that is the number, some say, of languages that was created when the Tower of Babel fell. So the number of languages that were created by God, basically as a communications curse on
right.
humans who were arrogantly building this tower to heaven.
And of course, this guy was, you tell some stories about this gentleman, and he traveled to Russia, and he came upon a Ukrainian who spoke to him. He says, "I don't recognize this." And I guess the gentleman referred to it as New Russian, as Ukrainian was known at that point. And a week or two, he says, "Well, let me learn about this." And a week or two later, he's fluent in Ukrainian.
Yeah, so the Russian was actually a visitor to the Vatican, I think.
Okay.
Mezzofanti, you know, for all of the languages that he had, he didn't leave. He never left Italy.
Oh, okay.
He didn't travel very far. He lived in an interesting time and had such a reputation that people actually came to him. So the languages that he learned were from people who were coming to visit him. He also went out to hospitals and hotels to meet native speakers. But yeah, in the case of this Russian, came up and said, started talking to him in Ukrainian, and it stumped Mezzofanti, but he said, you know, "Give me 2 weeks, I'll be back." And after 2 weeks, he was speaking in Ukrainian to the Russian, who was totally flabbergasted and asked Mezzofanti how he could do that. And Mezzofanti said, "Ah, well, I speak Russian, you know, Russian and Ukrainian. They're both Slavic languages. They're related to each other." And the Russian didn't think that that was possible. He thought there should be some other sort of, you know, darker secret there, kind of an esoteric secret that Mezzofanti should have. And the Russian claimed to have found it, to found Mezzofanti's secret, and said that he was going to build a polyglot college in Russian based on that method. But the plans for that disappeared, and then the Russian Revolution started, and this guy probably didn't survive that. So we don't know any more information about that story.
Well, and this gets to the other part, is that you're also looking for polyglots who can learn languages quickly too.
Yeah. So, you know, what was interesting about Mezzofanti was he was able to learn a lot of languages, but he was also able to use a lot of them simultaneously and switch among them very rapidly. So there are also these fantastic anecdotes about him being challenged by all of these students in the Vatican, each one speaking a different language and kind of besieging Mezzofanti, and how he was able to just go from one person to the next, switching in languages and addressing them in their native languages. And that's something that the contemporary hyperpolyglots also exhibit. You know, they can learn them very quickly. They have a great memory for a lot of languages, and they keep a lot of them on ice. And then they're able to use a great number, although there do seem to be some limits to the number of languages that they can keep active in their brains at the same time, and that seems to be about 5 to 9 languages. And there are some interesting brain reasons for that limit.
What areas of the brain are we using to learn new languages?
So let me talk about what multilingual people are doing when okay. they're using all of their languages. So what they're doing is they're taking all of those representations of language in the brain, and they're activating them all. So if you speak 5 languages to a very high degree, your brain, and you want to speak one, your brain says, okay, turn on all the language stuff. And then what your brain has to do is to shut off everything that's not the language that you know is the appropriate one to use. So that's why there's that limit on the number of languages that you can have activated at one time, just because it requires so much cognitive effort to keep all of those languages turned on and then have a certain number of them shut off at a certain point.
And I would assume this is all one part of the brain where language is a part of. Or are some of these polyglots using different parts of the brain?
Yeah, I think traditionally, you know, the notion is that language has a couple centers and is very focused in a couple areas, and that comes from an area of brain research that couldn't really peer into lots of different parts of the brain simultaneously and couldn't peer into the brain as it was working. Now we know that language functions take place in all parts of the brain, but what's interesting is that most of the activity does center on, if you're right-handed, on the left side of your brain in an area that's kind of in your temple, kind of right in front of your and above your ear. When you're learning another language, particularly as an adult, that area doesn't get involved so much. So the language kind of is more distributed because you're having to do more kind of conscious cognitive work and employing other parts of the brain. But over time and with practice, that activity will start to get consolidated in one part of the brain. And that's really what you're looking for to happen when you practice. And that's the thing that they're saying now is some of the source of some of the cognitive benefits of long-term, lifelong bilingualism that really has an effect, a positive effect, as people age. So it gives people what they call a cognitive reserve of some mental abilities.
So it sounds like this idea that it's far easier to learn a language early in life rather than later in life is absolutely true then.
Well, it's true and it's not true. So
Okay. So
the part of it about it that's true is that it's easier to become indistinguishable from a native speaker if you start very early, right? If you start later, and the later you start, the further you'll get from being able to acquire certain aspects of native speaker performance. Now, you'll still be able to learn things, and you'll still be able to do things that are meaningful. So if the goal is to become a native speaker, then, yeah, you should start as early as you can.
Is it a matter of accents or things like that, or is it more of phraseology?
You know, it's all of that. If the goal is to become a functional, intelligible speaker of the language, then you can start at any age. As you get older, you'll need to do more repetition, more work to fix the stuff in your brain, but it's still possible to do. Mm-hmm. So the way that I describe it is, to produce someone like me speaking English with the accent that I have, the vocabulary that I have, the grammar that I have, and the speaking ability that I have, you'd have to start very, very early. If you wanted to produce someone like me who has a little bit of an accent, you could start a little bit later. If you wanted to produce someone like me who has an accent, who maybe doesn't have a vocabulary that's as large, you could start even a little bit later. And if you wanted to produce someone like me who can speak fluently and is proficient, makes some mistakes, has a limited vocabulary, but can still communicate, then you could start even later. So it's this kind of gradient across the lifespan. I think because we're married to this notion that the only goal for speaking a language is to speak like a native speaker, that we take that notion of the critical period, that very early age, very seriously. I mean, it's important, but it also becomes a deterrent for people later in their life saying, well, I'm outside of that period, so I shouldn't even bother. That's not true at all.
And I think of all the people who come to America who speak to you, who have an accent, who have limited vocabularies, you're able to communicate with them. We should appreciate the fact that they're trying to speak to us in an English-speaking country in English. So I don't think,
absolutely.
I don't think
absolutely.
That's a, you know, the question I hear some people thinking is, you know, how important is it for Americans to know other languages? Even compared to a generation ago, English is spoken far wider around the globe. Today, nearly everywhere you go, there's going to be some English speaker. And of course, beyond just the etiquette reasons of being in, you know, a foreign land and you want to be able to speak the language. But so how important is it for us to know other languages?
You know, I think I'm one of those people who's going to say, you know, all the time I'm going to say that it's hugely important.
Yeah.
For any number of reasons. Even if you just take it from the economic investment perspective. You know, I met people who, there was a group I visited in Mexico called the Hippo Family Club, and their motto is, anyone can speak seven languages. And it's a family club that creates a multilingual, very fun multilingual atmosphere where people study seven languages. And all of those parents, you know, they're middle-class professional parents, speak Spanish, and they speak English. But why do they want those other languages? And I asked them, and they said, you know, everybody speaks English. It's not a competitive advantage anymore. So if you are going to be out on the job market doing certain kinds of work, expecting to have certain kinds of interactions and experiences, being able to take advantage of certain kinds of opportunities, speaking just English is not going to, you may be able to understand, right, what's going on, but really you'll be able to understand the note when they write back and say, we're not interested in you as a candidate because you haven't distinguished yourself. So the way to distinguish, one of the ways to distinguish oneself is to speak multiple languages. There's the cognitive, the long-term cognitive benefits as well. And even if we accept, okay, English is a language of international communication, it's very easy to go out and have meaningful interactions and do professional work in English, you still have to do some and make some linguistic investments. So you need to study the history of English, and it would help to study some linguistics because the people who are speaking English around the world are not native speakers, and their English is going to be influenced by the other languages that they speak. So you need to know something about why their English sounds the way that it does, so that as a native English speaker, you don't mistakenly judge them to be less intelligent than they actually are, to be making mistakes that they shouldn't make. And that's part of what's being called being globally competent, understanding how language works, but also understanding how language has these cultural aspects as well.
That idea of judging somebody by how well they speak, especially when it's not their native-born language, I think that's an easy thing to do. And I think knowing more languages, you know how hard it is.
Oh, yeah, you know, and yeah, you know, speaking Mandarin, I was teaching English to little kids, so I learned a lot of what they would say and a lot of words from them. And consequently, at the end of 2 years, I sounded like an 8-year-old, which was with some very adult tastes, say, and that I must have sounded like a very kind of strange adult, you know. Also because I knew that I couldn't be expected to be, you know, to do adult things or talk about adult things. I also couldn't read. I mean, reading Chinese characters requires just a huge amount of effort from anybody, even the polyglots. And for me to walk into a library or a bookstore in China or in Taiwan and to be rendered illiterate, effectively illiterate because it was all in Chinese, was such a profound experience that really changed my life in a lot of ways.
My guest today is Michael Erard. He's written about language for Science, Slate, Wired, The Atlantic, The New York Times. His latest book is titled Babel No More, and that's like the Tower of Babel, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. It's published by the Free Press. Well, in the book, you tell us about we learn about Cardinal Mezzafanti, a couple of other people, a German diplomat, Emil Krebs, Lom Kato, a Hungarian hyper-polyglot. But you also have some contemporary people who have learned how to speak a lot of languages. Probably the most interesting was Alexander Arguelles, who lives in California. He is a very devoted hyper-polyglot. I guess that's the easiest thing to say, but give us an example of how devoted he is.
So Alexander is someone who has not only studies a lot of languages, but studies a lot of languages at the same time. And for him and the way that his brain works, that really works for him. So in 15 to 20 minute chunks, he will spend anywhere from 6 to 9 hours working through a bunch of different languages. And at the time that I met him, he wasn't employed. He's married and has two kids. He was getting up at 2 or 3 in the morning and putting in 6 hours of study and then going for a 10-mile run. You know, and the languages were, he'd start with English, and then he would go to Sanskrit and Chinese and Arabic and Persian and Russian, and he had a whole set of languages that he was working on. He had studied something like 50 or 60 to some degree, and also kept a spreadsheet of all of the activities that he had done in all of the languages, so he could look back over the year and say, okay, I didn't do as much reading in French last year, so I don't want to lose that, so I'm going to maybe devote a little more time to that now. So I said at the time that he was not working. He now works as a language teaching specialist, appropriately enough, in Singapore. So he's a multilingual guy. He's married to a Korean woman. He speaks French to his kids, living in a multilingual city, working for a multilingual organization. I think that he's fairly happy now. I also talked to a woman who works for the World Bank. Her name is Helen Abadzi, and she's a native Greek. She speaks all of the official languages of the World Bank, but she also has this interesting job where she goes and she evaluates literacy programs that have been funded by the bank in different parts of the world. And what she does before she goes on one of these trips is she will study the local language and get a certain amount of proficiency so that she can talk to the local people about what is actually going on with the literacy programs. And her thinking is, and it must work for her, but that she gets kind of an authentic set of answers there and connects with people that she wouldn't get if they were using one of the official languages and if she was letting the officials do the translation for her. So she feels like she's able to do her job. She's interesting too, because at the Atlanta Olympics she was working as a translator for international visitors, and she was working in 10 languages simultaneously.
Wow.
I would have loved to see her doing that.
Yeah. Now, as you spoke to these folks, did they each have their own sort of systems for learning languages and keeping them up, or did they sort of have some common techniques?
I think the one thing that might be said to be common about all of them is, well, maybe two things. One was there was a lot of repetition, and they just had a tremendous even appetite for just doing things over and over and over again. And interestingly, both Helen and Alexander combined language learning activities, a lot of listening to tapes, with physical movement. So Alexander had this technique called shadowing, where you listen to a tape and you walk in very exaggerated ways and you try to pronounce what you're hearing at the same time that you're hearing it. And Helen likes to listen to tapes similarly while she's on an exercise bike or while she's riding a bicycle.
Interesting.
And that's one of the ways that she keeps things activated for
her. Do you think that the idea of making physical motion sort of frees up the brain, or is it just a way of passing the time while they're doing these very repetitive exercises?
I think there's a couple advantages to that. One is that, you know, the motor, the part of the brain that controls motor activity and kinetics is close to the language part of the brain on that left side for most of us. So there's some connection there. We also know, and this was something I discussed in my first book, that people who are able to gesture with their hands have an easier time finding the words. So there's some connection between gesture, motor activity, and activation of language. So there's that piece. There's also the other piece of, if you're doing something particularly in public in an exaggerated way like Alexander does, you are making yourself feel more comfortable having people look at you and wondering what that strange person is doing.
It could work.
Yeah, it could, and it does. He tried that method with me. We did a little work with Hindi, and in a park in Berkeley. And the I still remember to this day a lot of the Hindi that we went over, and I definitely felt funny doing it. And I didn't do it long enough that I would have my I would be less embarrassed speaking Hindi, but it was interesting.
Interesting. So it's the exercises you did while you were in this public situation, and you know, that fear of looking funny seemed to imprint the lessons a little better.
Yeah, I think so. And there was also this element of, you know, I was emotionally motivated. I was a little more, I think, activated because I was with Alexander, you know, who spends all his time doing this, and I was going to impress him. By gosh.
Well, now, we've talked a little bit about brain research, but one of the interesting things is that really brain researchers are really not too much interested in this, are they?
Not so much in the question of how many languages someone can speak. And, you know, we're really at the infancy of understanding how the brain works with multiple languages and where that ability comes from as brains develop. And also the connection between different learning styles and how brains develop. We're at the absolute infancy of trying to understand that and trying to potentially manipulate that, you know. So the question of how could we make polyglot brains, or how could we make brains that have an easier time learning, is probably something that we will see happening more and more of in our lifetime. There's already a number of questions about cognitive enhancements and the ethics of that and the safety of doing that. I think we're going to see much, much more of that happening, particularly as the population ages and as the brain science gets better at understanding how the brain can rewire itself after things like stroke, and what sort of therapies would work with those people and could then be safely used on normal populations. So there's one technology called transcranial direct current stimulation that applies a very low voltage of electricity to certain parts of the brain, and you can either activate neurons or you can suppress neural activity. And when you direct that at certain language-related areas of the brain, people are able to learn new words and remember them longer, and they're also able to learn grammatical rules better and remember them longer. Mm. So that is definitely an area, and that's going to be specifically a therapy that's aimed at people who have had strokes.
Yeah, maybe lost language or whatever.
Right, yeah, or someone like Gabrielle Giffords.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting book. The name is Babel No More. Michael Erard, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Rich. It was fun.
Linguist Michael Erard is the author of Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. It's published by the Free Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online at publicradiotulsa.org or subscribe to the Studio Tulsa podcast. That's available for free at the iTunes Store. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.